Hello, everybody. Welcome to another episode of the Comic Source Podcast. I'm your host, Jace. This is a Friday Spotlight episode. Today, I'm going to be talking about a few different DC comics, starting with Freedom Fighters number 3. So this book is written by Robert Venditti, pencils by Eddie Barrows, inks by Iber Ferreira, colors by Adriana Lucas, and letters by And World Design. This is the maxi series, the 12-issue series, about the Freedom Fighters, those classic characters that DC bought from Fawcett back in the day, but in a different setting than we've seen them before. You know, when DC brought them in, tried to incorporate them, they were supposedly on Earth X in the DC multiverse. In that world, they were still fighting the war, Nazis in World War II. So what Venditti has done in this series is extrapolated that out. You know, what if the Nazis had won the war and now we're looking at, you know, years and years later, what happens? Can America fight back, sort of thing? And so in the first couple of issues, that's what it's been focused on. America having their heroes once again, these new versions of these Freedom Fighter characters coming back and trying to inspire Americans, which in turn will inspire the return of Uncle Sam. So actually in issue 3, when it starts off, it's November 25th, 1963, which you may recognize as the date of the Kennedy assassination. In this world, in the world of the Freedom Fighters, it's the date that the Nazis finally stopped that first version of the Freedom Fighters when they captured the Human Bomb and Doll Man and Black Condor. And as I said, in this issue, it starts off, it is that date. It is November 25th, 1963. And we see Adolf Hitler still alive. He's in a wheelchair. He's on oxygen. He's watching a broadcast as the Black Condor, Human Bomb, and Doll Man are executed. And we're also told by the newsmen that Jesse Owens, very famous athlete from the 1936 Olympic Games who beat the Nazis in some of the races there and, kind of rubbed it in Hitler's face, so to speak, because those games were held in Germany and, you know, Hitler was all about the Aryan race and, you know, the white race being superior, blonde hair, blue eyes, all that sort of thing. And he was the leader of the resistance, as it were. And so he's been captured along with these Freedom Fighters and they've all been executed and he's been sentenced to hard labor in a facility for the rest of his life. And the newsman says, well, how does first place feel now, Mr. Owens? You could run, but you could not hide. And we're told in the great honor of this final victory, the Fuhrer has decreed that henceforth that day will be celebrated as a national holiday. So Venditti kind of throwing us a twist there, a day in American history that, you know, is always remembered with sadness for the loss of JFK is in this world, in this reality, a holiday and not for good reasons. So, as I said, Hitler's watching this play out and he's actually at the Waldorf Astoria in New York. His son is there and they're in a ballroom. People are celebrating and drinking and, you know, happy that they've finally defeated everybody. And Adolf Hitler II goes up to his father and says, look, father, they're showing your great victory on TV. And the elderly Hitler is saying, well, have you caught him though? Have you caught Uncle Sam? And his son says, oh, don't you remember? I already told you. The plastic men say that he vanished. He evaporated. We saw that at the end of issue 1. That he's gone, and the rest of the Freedom Fighters were executed just like you always wanted. And the Elder Fuhrer erupts, saying, it's meaningless. That's all meaningless. The only thing that matters is Uncle Sam. And the younger Hitler saying, but this broadcast is aired on every channel all across America. If Uncle Sam were still out there, he knows the resistance is over. So it's over. We've achieved final victory. And the younger Hitler knows better, and he yells at his son saying, hey, Uncle Sam is the spirit of this nation. And as long as he exists, so does America. But as he says that, he actually has a heart attack. He's got himself so worked up, and he kind of crumples, falls from his chair, and dies. And some of the troops come running up. The Fuhrer, he's dead. One of the senior officers comes up to Adolf Hitler's son, Adolf Hitler II, and says, "You need to join me in the bunker, sir. You've got to be fully briefed at once." And the son is distraught, you know, there with his hands on his father's shoulders. And he says, my father, he's, and the intelligence officer replies, finishing the sentence, "Gone, he's gone. The future of the Third Reich is yours. Heil Hitler." And they, the whole room salutes him, Heil Hitler. So they say that the propaganda machine won't stop, that people will hear of the Fuhrer's noble passing, continuity of government's important. And the younger son is like, it happened so fast. And the intelligence officer says, and what of your father's words? Uncle Sam is a problem that still requires solving. But the younger Hitler says, you know what? He may be the spirit of America, but today we executed that spirit for good. So his belief is that even though they didn't capture Uncle Sam, that they won. So on the next page, the scene shifts to Lake Michigan today. 800 feet below the surface, we see the human bomb returning to this mobile base of operations for the resistance. And they let him in. And he says, me and the doll woman, we almost got nabbed doing that recon. We barely got away, but they did manage to give the ratsies, as they call them, the slip. And they say, we shouldn't stay here long. As soon as we finish this mission, I'm going to move the blue tracer. That's the ship they're on that can fly and go underwater and all that sort of thing. They can't leave it there they don't like to stay in one place for very long, right? It's too dangerous. So with that plan in place, we turn the page and, we're told Black Condor better be ready to do his part in this plan that they've had. And this new Black Condor, he's not just named Black Condor, he's actually a black man. So you could easily see why he would want to fight against the Nazis and their, you know, dream of a white world where everybody else is sort of secondary. And he's remembering back to being persecuted on and, you know, the things that he had to deal with being a black man growing up in Nazi America. And we see that he and his father were working in an automotive plant, and his father's being abused by one of the workers there, saying, "Why don't you teach your son the difference between a Phillips head screwdriver and a flathead, or I'll pull you back off the line and put you in the toilet house." And Condor's remembering this and thinking about how sorry he is. And Phantom Lady shows up and says, does Cache, and Cache is the one who flies the ship and seems to be somewhat of a leader of the resistance. She says, "Does Cache know you're using his technology to hack into Ratsy's cameras?" And Black Condor says, it's only 200 miles away from here. You know, and that's where he grew up. That's where, you know, as he's watching these cameras, he's reminded of working in those automotive factories with his family and where his dad was abused and such. And Black Condor we can go and liberate that factory city today. We have the ability to do that, and feel like he's actually making a difference. And Phantom Lady's response is, and then what, Marcus? "It doesn't do any good if they're free, but they have no place safe to go. The day hasn't come for us to do that yet, but it will." And Black Condor saying, "Yeah, you can be patient. You weren't born a slave. You didn't have to abandon everyone you knew because the wings could only carry you over the wall." And Phantom Lady's like, "Look, Marcus, you think of it this way. America itself is behind a wall. And that's why I joined the Freedom Fighters, to knock it down. But we got to have Uncle Sam. We need him to help lead us. That's the only way that we're going to win. And the only way to free him is to make people believe that's possible again, so Uncle Sam can return." And Black Condor is, that's not enough for him. He turns on Phantom Lady and says, what do you know about walls? You know, your daddy was a big deal lawyer for the Ratsies, and he gave you the perfect life. And he wrote the law that kept the rest of us in the ghettos. You chose to be a freedom fighter, Phantom Lady. Well, hey, great for you. But I never had any choices. My choices were all taken away from me. And that I'm doing the only thing that was left to me. And that affects Phantom Lady pretty strongly. You know, she has some tears and she says, you're right. I had choices and everyone else stood for my father while I sat. I knew that it was wrong. And I grew up with every advantage, but do you think that makes things better or worse for me? You aren't the only one with guilt. You got away and Black Hunter got away and he feels guilty that the rest of his family and the other persons of color he knows are still trapped working in the factory city of Detroit. But Phantom Lady grew up privileged knowing that was on the backs of those people with labor and knowing it was wrong. So, you know, she suffers in her own way. Anyway, she gives up trying to get through to Black Condor and turns away and says, Cache says it's time, so be safe, Marcus. So next we see on the command deck of the Blue Tracer, it's 2 minutes till go time. Phantom Lady is there, Human Bomb's there, Doll Woman is there, and Cache is saying, okay, Doll Woman copied the file from the downed Bozo, which is a giant Nazi combat machine robot type thing that we saw blown up in the first issue. And the information we got from there allowed Cache to hack into the Ratsy network and find the location they're looking for. And so now Black Condor is going to launch himself as a mobile antenna, and Cache is going to bounce a signal off of Black Condor, who's wearing this mobile antenna pack, so the signal can't be traced back to the Blue Tracer, so they can do what they need to do without being found out and losing their headquarters. So he says, when the hack is complete, I'll punch the disengage and release the antenna pack. And Black Hunter's like, okay, we went over it 100 times. I get it. Let's get on with it. I'm tired of being cooped up in your tin can, you know, hidden underwater. So he goes ahead and launches off. They initiate the hack and they're sending the signal. And it's not too long before this signal and this broadcast is detected in Chicago by the Nazis at the Chicago Luftwaffe airfield, and they send some combat air patrols to intercept the signal to find out what it is. So as Black Condor is flying around up there, he radios in and tells his teammates, "Hey, it just got really crowded up here. There's 4 jets closing on his position." And Cache says, that's a lot faster than we estimated. And Black Condor says, don't sweat it. And he kind of extends his wings, and they're more than just feathers like the original Black Condor. They're much more like Archangel's wings, Archangel from the X-Men, where they're sort of metallic. And it's not too long before he turns around and swings back and attacks the jets full on, and manages to take one of them out by cutting the bottom of it open with his wings. And he says, you know, I've been cooped up for too long, so I want to clear the air. So he's glad that he's able to attack back. Meanwhile, the jets are calling back to the airfield saying it's Black Condor, freedom fighters are attacking. And Black Condor is now sort of in air combat, being fired on by the other jets, asking how much time Cache needs, and says, I'm not quite there yet. I need more time. Black Condor's actually happy to hear that because it gives him a chance to take out a few more jets. And he actually has projectiles that he can fire from his wings as well that take out another one. And back at the airfield, they're saying there's 2 fighters down, and we've detected the signal that's coming from the target, and it's a data signal. And that's when the airfield and the Nazi command there realize that it's a cyber attack as well. And Phantom Lady's telling Cache, you know, this is taking too long. You're going to get Black Condor killed. You need to disengage the antenna. And Cache's like, not yet. We this is important. We've got to complete the mission. So the Nazis realize how important it is to stop this signal and stop the cyber attack. So they clear the fighters out and they say, lock the anti-aircraft batteries onto the signal and fire. And so human bombs now on Phantom Lady's side, telling Cache, we've got to get him out of there. And Cache say, not yet, not yet. And we see that the Razzies fire off all their anti-aircraft weapons, and there's four missiles that are homing in on the signal that are going to basically kill Black Condor because he's wearing this antenna that they're tracking. So it's getting close. Cache's like, I'm almost there. And Black Condor's saying, Cache, get this thing off me. And he starts taking it off himself because the missiles are getting really close. And at the last second, Cache says, got it, pull up. And Cache hits the disengage button. The antenna pack is ejected. Black Condor manages to go into a very steep climb as the missiles explode behind him, destroying the pack. So once that happens, the data signal that the Nazis were tracking disappears, and they believe that they've destroyed the target. And the commander of the airfield wants to know, well, did the explosion disrupt our communications? Because all of a sudden, none of our screens are receiving anything. And Black Condor radios into his friend saying, hey, I'm all right. See you at the rendezvous. Mind telling us what took so long? And Cache said, well, not only did I do what we originally planned on doing, but I also uploaded a little something to the Ratsy network. You know, the hack gave me access to their entire digital infrastructure, so I can do things like this. And he clicks a button, and all across the entire country, the American flag is once again shown on all the screens. First time many people have seen it in many, many years. And the Star Spangled Banner, or rather, God Bless America starts playing. And some members of the Freedom Fighters, they're so young, they don't even know what it is. They're saying, what is that song? What is that music playing? And Doll Woman says, yeah, it makes me want to punch a Ratsy in the bleep. And Cache is smiling there and saying, it's God Bless America by Irving Berlin. So as all this is unfolding, the scene shifts to the White House, which is the official residence of the Fuhrer. And it's at 1600 Berliner Strasse rather than at 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue. And we see one of the plastic men, who are these Nazi secret police who have the powers of plastic man. And they're reporting to Adolf Hitler II, the current Fuhrer. And he's saying it's as reported from Dallas, the Freedom Fighters are trying to rally the people to bring back Uncle Sam. And now they're spreading American propaganda within our own systems. And so the Fuhrer doesn't seem to be too worried about it. He said it's going to take a lot more than cheap music and leaflets. So take down the networks, infiltrate this purge, hold someone responsible. I don't care who, you know, just make an example of somebody. And beginning right now, all Plastic Man will report to Addy. And the Plastic Man is he's sort of taken aback. He says, are you certain he's ready? Because his performance was less than stable last time. And the Fuhrer says, I don't need him to be stable. I just need an explosion that'll snuff out this fire. And if there's one thing my son is good for, it's exploding. So the Freedom Fighters need to be brought to justice quickly, or people are going to begin to wonder why our hero isn't intervening. And so the Plastic Man says, we'll give the people what they fear then. Maybe this is a job for Overman. And the Fuhrer says, yeah, we'll play that move when there's no alternative. But if we solve this problem quickly enough, the people will understand that the Reich no longer needs Overman. And in that way, maybe we can, you know, pull a silver lining out of this. Maybe the Freedom Fighters have given us an opportunity. But if the resistance goes unchecked and Uncle Sam does indeed come back, America's going to look to the skies. And, you know, the final sound they're going to hear is their own scream if we have to release Overman. So we see at the mobile interrogation unit of Adolf Hitler III, apparently this is the unstable genius, you'd call him, Adolf Hitler III, son of the current Fuhrer, who has apparently been torturing somebody, because we see a man in the background in shadows, and he is strung up by his literal flesh. We see all these hooks, and he's kind of hanging there. There's blood everywhere, including on Adolf Hitler III. And he answers a call saying, yes, that was awful. I didn't realize I've been preoccupied, but tell Daddy I'll take care of everything. It sounds like fun. And we get a blurb for the next issue saying Sam lives. So in the next issue, we would expect, based on that, to see Uncle Sam return, which will have repercussions, obviously, based on what Adolf Hitler II has told his Plastic Man in this issue. So I love this story. I love this series. I've talked extensively in the past about the incredible color work that Adriana Lucas does. It's what makes the art really shine. There's always at least one or two pages where there's some sort of explosion or some sort of use of color that just jumps off the page and looks like a light source in and of itself. So some of the best color work I've seen in comics ever, really. I mean, it's done so well. The Eddie Barrows art, especially during the action scenes, the air combat scenes with Black Condor and the jets, is handled really, really well. There's a lot of emotional panels. And this is really an emotional story. When you talk about characters needing to show emotion, facial expression or body language based on the impact of the story and the history, the sort of character backgrounds that Rubber Venditti is giving us here. You know, we're talking about people who love their country, people who have suffered, people who are not just, you know, it's one thing to have a superhero story where the hero is fighting for good or right or justice or whatever you call it, putting the bad guys away. It's another thing. These people are so loyal to the idea of what America is supposed to be. And it's the choices they've made, the risks they're taking to fight against the Razzies, as they call them. It's just a powerful message. And the Eddie Barrows line work and the Adriana Lucas color, the Iber Ferreira inks, all of it really comes together to show those visuals really, really well. And the other thing that Eddie Barrows does is, this isn't just, you know, page after page of nine panels or four panels or, you know, whatever. He varies up the shape of the panels. He does insets. Sometimes we have these diagonal shaped panels. And so I'm always a big fan when the artist changes it up and it's not just the same sort of page layouts in terms of panels, page after page. Same thing with the camera angles, and the camera work is done very well here. Also, it's just a very, very underrated series. So highly, highly recommend it. All right, let's move on to Justice League number 20. This is written by Scott Snyder and Jorge Jimenez. As far as the plot goes, Snyder handles the dialogue or the scripting. Jorge Jimenez handles the art. Alejandro Sanchez is on colors and Tom Napolitano is on letters. So we saw at the end of issue 19 where Superman came back from the sixth dimension, but he had aged many, many years, and he came back to get the rest of the Justice League to tell them that, yes, he found a way to stop the impending doom and to stop Perpetua and to solve the problem that began with the Justice League breaking the source wall. And by going to the sixth dimension, he was able to find an answer to that. And he needs them all to come with him now so that they can understand what it is that he found and how they can sort of stop the impending destruction of the universe that Perpetua is trying to make happen. So we're told that the simplest point is simplest dimension is a point. So that's first dimension. Next is a line. That would be second dimension. It extends that line along a single vector moving toward wherever it's meant to go. It can be a thread, it can be a bridge, or even a threshold that once crossed will change everything forever. So in the sixth dimension, the rest of the Justice League come through the doorway, and Superman tells them, or this older Superman tells them, let me be the first to welcome you to the House of Justice. And so they look upon it, and it's like the Hall of Justice, but it's vast with all kinds of statues and memorials and such like that. And they're saying, wow, this place is enormous. And Martian Manhunter is saying, well, I don't sense any shields or defenses. And this older Superman says, well, no, it's open in every sense of the word, John. It's more of a museum now. You know, we won, and so it's a tribute to justice and how it won the day. And we see this banner that's hanging up that kind of incorporates the symbol that we've seen for the Hall of Justice, as well as the symbol that we've seen for Doom, as well as every other line. All the lines are present in that circular symbol. And the older Superman is saying, the flag is more than a banner. It's the shape of the multiverse. And it's hard won, but it's true. And John says, oh, it's like the full formation. Every line is there. But how did we do this? And as he says that, the rest of the future Justice League shows up as well. And John's future self replies, well, you follow the path you're on now, but it's going to take you in a direction that, and he gets interrupted by a young boy who looks like a young John, but has wings like a Hawkgirl. And this young boy says, mother, father, it's so odd to see these versions of you. I sense they're still like strangers to one another. And the older Hawkwoman says, oh yes, little heart, that was a different time. And Batman says, speaking of time, Clark, we don't have much. And Wonder Woman says, yes, if we're going to go to war against Doom, what's your battle plan? And Superman says, we'll get there, Bruce, I promise. And the future Batman says, yeah, you got to understand the stakes of what's happening right now. And the older woman, Wonder Woman, says, yeah, what they need is the truth, but a warning that it's much more frightening than what you're prepared to understand, to realize. And Flash says, well, it's already pretty scary. How much worse could it get? I mean, the source wall is destroyed. And the future Flash says, yeah, the source wall is destroyed. Luther's raising a cosmic goddess. The future John Stewart adds, to top it all off, the broken multiverse is now hurtling through the void. And the present day John Stewart says, yeah, so how do we avert it all? And Superman, the future Superman, tells him, well, John, you can't. And that's the true lesson of this place, this world. And it's what I learned by exploring every option, right? Like, supposedly Superman went there, and the reason he was gone so long is because he literally followed billions of iterations, billions of threads, billions of possible futures. And he says, it's what I learned by following all those options, that what we need to do is we need to speed up that multiverse that's hurling through the void. And once we do that, we may have a solution. So right now, the multiverse is hurling through the void, and the question we need to ask is, where is it going? So what I'm about to tell you is known to only the highest beings. So in the Omniverse, when one multiverse breaks before it reaches its final evolution, it's sent back to the beginning, to the banks of creation, where it was created. And Batman says, well, created by who? Well, by the celestial beings like Perpetua, who, you know, Lex is trying to revive right now. And Martian Manhunter says, but according to Martian Keep, Perpetua was, and he gets interrupted. And Superman says, future Superman says, yes, we know she went rogue, right? She was supposed to create the multiverse and then die. Basically, was her role. That's the role of those progenerators, right? They're supposed to create the universe and then die, and they pass it on to others to look after. But she, we know, was selfish and was covered in a couple issues ago. She didn't let herself die, and she wanted to make it in her own image, and so on and so forth. So he goes on to say, yeah, she created our multiverse using 7 unnatural energies because she wanted to create something vicious that wouldn't evolve to its final form and then, you know, pass away and then be reborn. She wanted a multiverse that was eternal. She was breaking the laws of nature. So her sons, the ones that, you know, in a typical multiverse, again, you have a perpetual like being who creates it, and then they create other, you know, beings, I guess you'd say, who are not quite as powerful as the being that created the universe, but they're the ones that are supposed to be the caretakers, and then that being that created the multiverse passes on. So she created the monitor, the anti-monitor, and the world forger. And when they realized what Perpetua was doing, that she hadn't passed on, that she still existed, she was still manipulating things, they alerted the others like Perpetua to what she was doing. And that's how Perpetua got caught. That's how she was embedded in the source wall. And they remade the multiverse properly that time. But now the source wall has been broken, Perpetua is free. And the goal of any multiverse is to achieve a harmonious form. So Perpetua's goal is not to do that, right? She wants to turn our multiverse away from justice toward doom so that it can be a weapon. And she can use it as a way to destroy the others like her who, you know, were impertinent enough to imprison her. She wants to use our multiverse as a weapon to destroy those that that imprisoned her. So what needs to happen is you've got to take control of the multiverse from Perpetua and help it receive or achieve a higher form, that harmonious form, that form filled with justice, so that by the time it reaches the end of its evolution and reaches the banks of judgment, it'll be deemed worthy and it gets allowed to continue to exist. So Batman says, Clark, you know, I was skeptical of coming here, but I'm listening to you, and this is what you found. So you just tell it, how do we do that? And Superman says, oh, forgive me, Bruce. It's just odd hearing you ask that question, because you're the one who, he goes, you know what? It doesn't matter now. We can talk tomorrow. But I think that you all need to go and explore this world today. There are hard days ahead, but on the other side, it can allow dreams to come true. So please go out and see what this world is like. See what we're fighting for. So we turn the page, and it's interesting and fun sort of scene where Batman is chasing Deathstroke across a rooftop in Gotham. It's raining, and Deathstroke's saying, you're too late, Batman. I'm home free. He goes jumping off the side of the building. Batman's out of breath saying, Robin, he's getting away. Can you? And he says, I'm on it, Dad. And who it actually is it's Jarro. It's Jarro, and he's in a Robin costume, full cape. And he slams into Deathstroke's face, and Deathstroke's like, what the, ugh, and he falls over, and Jarro says, Deathstroke, more like death joke, am I right? And Batman has now managed to get down to the ground, where Deathstroke's laying prone with Jarro stuck on his face, police cars behind him, about to take Deathstroke into company, and Batman laughs at the joke, saying, ha, son, that's why you're my favorite Robin ever. And Jarro says, no, stop. He goes, no, I mean it. My favorite ever. And on the next page, we see Mira knocking on Jarro's jar, trying to wake him up. And she's saying, Jarro, wake up. So it's clear that he was dreaming. And, you know, in his dream, that's what Jarro dreams of, about Batman calling him the best Robin ever. So they wake him up. It's Mira and Starman there. They're in the Hall of Justice, and they want to know why Mr. Mixius Pidalic all of a sudden has this energy cocoon surrounding him, and they're worried that there's something going on. And Jarro says, well, there's a voice, there's something in his head. I said, well, what's it saying? Well, it's telling him he must do what they agreed on and erase the line before it's too late. So that sounds kind of ominous. Meanwhile, back in the sixth dimension, out on Black Hawk Island, the current Kendra Sanders, Hawk Girl, and the current John Jones, Martian Manhunter, are being shown the spaceport that flies out to all planets by their older selves, as well as the child that apparently is theirs, that they that they had. They're basically married. Shane is his name. And they're being told that John was a big part of how they won the day. He was the one that connected all the heroes together on the great mission. And Kendra was the messenger bird telling John how much to reveal and what to conceal and what to show the world. And they were, you know, very much a part of the victory that they had. And they introduce their younger versions to their son, Shane. And they say, apologize that he's so shy. He's hyper empathic and he's highly conductive. And sometimes it's too much emotion for him. So you've got to be careful. So meanwhile, in Metropolis, the younger or current present time, John Stewart and the present Barry Allen Flash are at Star Laboratories with their future selves. And they're like, wait, you guys are literally rebuilding the multiverse, like right here, right now. And Barry says, yeah, we're now that the war is over, we can put back what was lost or even expand. So in that Star Laboratories of Metropolis, they're basically creating new planets. They're designing new worlds and then giving them energy and shooting them out into existence, basically. And Barry says, yeah, we situate them in time and space. We still use the speed and the steel force to collapse hypertime, and it helps them to basically put the pieces of the multiverse back together. And current time Barry says, wait, collapse hypertime, but the repercussions. And future Barry says, oh, well, that's the thing. We control the time stream here. It's no longer perilous to travel through it. So we're able to do things we never could before. Like you can go visit your mother or Iris or the kids or the grandkids or the great, great grandkids. And so that brings a smile to Barry's face. And the future versions of the hero saying, it's not just the multiverse that evolves after the war. It's all of us, bigger and better. And John Stewart says, yeah, it's a flash fact. Here in this place, we create more than the possible. We create wonders. So on the island of Themyscira, the older Wonder Woman is showing the younger Diana around. And the younger Diana is surprised to see that the island has grown and the veil is gone. And the older Wonder Woman is saying, yeah, during the war, there were many cruel battles there fought with magic. And in the days after, it was Diana herself who felt the island needed a new purpose. And so it became somewhat of a school or a library. So they created a library with a universal language that allowed anybody who wanted to come to learn. And it was devoted to protecting and serving as a reservoir, all the great truths that brought light to the darkest corners of life, basically. Next, we are seeing Gotham, which looks nothing like any Gotham we've ever seen. Bright, bright, bright city. A lot of buildings are white. There's a statue of Batman watching over all. And Batman is, Bruce Wayne, current Bruce Wayne Batman is being shown around by the future Batman saying, well, what do you think of Gotham? And he says, well, it's bright. He said, yeah, that big fiery ball in the sky, it's called the sun. But, you know, it does take some getting used to. And Superman says, well, Bruce, we know it's a lot, this place, but it's a testament to your dream and your work. And future Batman says, yeah, Clark's right. You know, I'm joking, but more than anything, I want to thank you, not as Batman, but as your family, as Dick Grayson. So future Batman is Dick Grayson. And he says, no one gives more to this war than you do, Bruce. You sacrificed everything, even your life. And Superman says, yes, but thanks to you, no child's ever going to have to go through what you went through ever again. And Dick says, yeah, we know you expected to fight forever, but here you'll always be a symbol for what's best about us. And Bruce, you know, ever the stoic soldier, he doesn't really let any of that get to him. He just says, I have questions. And Superman says, well, of course you do. Right. But the solution is here. And the world is built on those facts. You know, this, this is real, and this is an extension of your thinking more than anyone else. So what are your questions? And Batman says, well, first of all, where are all the villains? You know, how is this world such a bright place and no one's fighting against it? So as we turn the page, we're back on Black Hawk Island, and Kendra and John, the present time, Kendra and John are talking about how beautiful the world is, but John's worried it's a little unsettling. And Kendra's like, unsettled? Why would you be unsettled? Just because we met our future selves and we're married and we have a child. But no, John, I'm kidding. There's something else bothering you, right? And John says, well, it's just those future versions of myself. They said that, you know, I was the one that shepherded this world and told people what to do, basically. And you were the one carrying that message. But they talked about concealing the truth, like what to tell the world and what not. And my biggest fear before we came to this place was we should always tell the truth. And Kendra's like, yeah, the whole thing about what's going on back in our world was that we all felt like we should have told the world what was really happening with the wall dying and everything. And John's like, yeah, that's what my entire journey has been about this year. And it's taught me more than anyone, or you rather, you've taught me more than anyone that pursuing the truth, good, bad, or ugly is what matters. We shouldn't conceal anything. And as they're having this conversation, they consider talking to their future selves about their concerns. And a voice off panel says, no, and it's Shane. And he says, you mustn't tell them how you feel. You must flee now. And they get up and they walk over to the young boy, and they're like, what are you talking about? What is it? Why are you so frightened? I mean, he has tears coming out of his eyes and everything. And Shane says, well, this people, these place, they're not what you think. I'll show you. And his eyes glow brightly, and all of a sudden they're shocked by what they learn. Say, my God, no, it can't be. Meanwhile, back on Earth, Mixius Pitalik has grown. He's absorbing all this power from somewhere, growing to this huge size. And Starman and Mirror are telling him to stop, saying you got to break free of whatever's controlling you. And this giant-sized Mixius Pitalik says, it's far too late for that, Sea Queen. It's too late for any of that. And he grows so large that he busts out of the top of the Hall of Justice. Meanwhile, back at the Hall of Doom, Brainiac and Luthor are watching Mixius Pitalik burst out of the top of the Hall of Justice. And Brainiac's saying, I warned you, Luthor, you can't even measure the power of Mixius Pitalik. And Luthor's not worried at all. He goes, here I thought you were the universe's greatest living calculator and you could figure out how powerful anybody was. And Brainiac's like, a fifth dimensional imp? He doesn't really have any limits of power. And if you think that we can fight him, and Luthor's like, no, stop thinking in two dimensions. Use your imagination and think what we'd do for a second if we had our own imp. And behind a secret door, he lifts up a box that has looks to be a bat symbol, but instead of a bat in the middle of it, it's got this little squiggly lightning bolt, but it's got that yellow oval that we identify with Batman. Meanwhile, on the next page, we get our first inkling that things aren't maybe what they seem, because supposedly Superman had evolved to that and aged to that older Superman that we saw wearing the white costume and the beard and whatnot. But as we turn the page here, we see this barren landscape, no light to be seen. And we're told he lands hard in the exact same rut as last time and the time before that and the 50 times before that. But even so, he gets up, he dusts himself off, and he leaps again along the same axis. And as we're seeing this, we're watching Superman try to fly up and crash back down and try to fly up and crash back down over and over and over. And Superman hears it like a voice in the air telling him that the light that he sees in the distance, that's where all his friends belong, and that light leads to the future. But you, the voice says, your life from the rocket till now, all of it, everything, it was one line. And it's a speeding bullet, a locomotive, a leap, and it's always landing right here. And the voice he's hearing is actually the voice of that future Superman. And he appears before the Superman we know, and he says, "So let's talk, Clark." And so come to find out that Superman that we thought had found a solution, the one that told us that he knew the pathway and the way to stop Doom from happening and stop Perpetua, appears to not really be Superman at all. So who he might be, well, I guess we're going to have to wait and see next issue. So this is an interesting turn of events for sure. I mean, you always had your suspicions that the world that we're shown in this issue was too good to be true. Obviously, whatever John Jones and Kendra Saunders learned from Shane is very troublesome. The fact that Shane didn't want them to go to their future versions. The fact that Bruce Wayne is gone, because he would never be one to compromise if something were not above board, and he's not there. So it's all these little clues that are sort of adding up to be not what we're told, you know, not this bright future world that exists. It seems like our heroes in the present day Justice League could be in some sort of trap, you know, whether that's it's all an illusion, they're not really awake, or what it might be, we don't know at this point. But the other thing I'll say about this issue is some really great moments. The whole Jaro scene as the best Robin ever is just fantastic. It's scenes like that with Jaro that just make me love the fact that character exists. The emotional scenes with the heroes and their older selves. Like, it's great to think about getting to this point of this world where everyone's at peace and there doesn't seem to be crime or disease or poverty, starvation, any of that. It's very much a utopia, something that every hero would want to see and work toward, right? But it also brings up the thoughts of, well, it's too good to be true, right? And then to see Superman at the end of the issue trying to escape, you know, you worry, like, what the heck's going on here, and who is this imposter Superman? And then, of course, the whole idea of who's controlling Mixius Pitalik, and why did he all of a sudden, you know, grow out of control and start wielding this incredible amount of power, and what does it have to do with the Legion of Doom? So still a lot of questions to be answered, and I hear a lot of people say they don't like this Justice League run by Scott Snyder, and I get it. It's really complicated and convoluted at times, and it can be hard to follow, but a big part of the reason I like it so much is I've talked in the past about how I feel like the Justice League book should be at the center of the DC universe. It should connect everything together. And that is the case with Snyder's run on Justice League, more so than anything. It really drives forward the whole narrative of the DC universe for a long period of time. And I know some people don't like that. They don't like the direction that the DC universe took, with all the events that happen that eventually leads into Dark Knight's death metal. And I get that. I think that that's sort of a matter of taste, and I don't think it's the best story ever. I think it started off and then it kind of got messy as it went along with the whole Year of the Villain stuff. And it did get a little too big and a little too convoluted. It could have been done better. You know, I've said before that I don't think that Scott Snyder's the best when it comes to running events, because I think he has too many ideas and there's too much to squeeze in, and the narrative can get sort of choppy. And it was really evident to me when I don't think it was the last issue of Death Metal. I think it might have been one of the tie-in issues of Death Metal that came out the same week as the Generation Shattered issue, the Generation Shattered event, which is two issue event, and that just felt so much more clean. It felt better planned out, better put together, and the juxtaposition of that, it was almost like, man, I forgot what it's like to have an event where you kind of see that it's put, and it's not necessarily just because there's space in it to have all the answers, because there's still plenty of questions that aren't answered in that Generation Shattered. It's just the way it's presented. I don't even know it's something I could put my finger on, but just the way that it's presented, it feels so much more cohesive than some of the later events that Scott has done, like Metal, Dark Knight's Metal and Dark Knight's Death Metal. So again, it's just a personal preference thing. And all that being said, I still love his Justice League run. I think it, you know, when you talk about the big ideas and the big concepts of it, it's great. I love it. I love Death Metal for the same reason, in terms of what it says about the DC universe and what it tries to do. Does it fall short sometimes in execution? Yeah, but that's not seeing the forest for the trees. I think overall, with what it says about the DC universe and how much Scott cares about the DC universe and cares about these characters is very self-evident. So I do think that this Justice League run is definitely worth checking out. All right, let's move on to the last book. It's Aquaman number 46. This is written by Kelly Sue DeConnick. We have pencils by Robson Rocha, inks by Daniel Enriquez, colors by Sunny Gao, and letters by Clayton Cowles. So last issue, we learned all about the history of the gods of Earth. First there was Father Sea and Mother Salt, and then the gods that they birthed, which, you know, what was it, sky and the wind and fire and earth, and then everything, you know, and all of creation came from them. And then when Father Earth or Father Sea rather didn't like sort of the way things were going, he was going to flood the earth and start everything again. And when their four children learned of this, they killed their father, and in a rage, Mother Salt split her being, not voluntarily, but just as sort of a reaction to what happened. In her rage and her grief, she split into seven different entities that went out and tried to kill those four gods, and they eventually were all turned away, and the four gods, which are kind of like the four elements, they all repented for what they had done, and their mother gathered, Mother Salt gathered all seven of her pieces back together to reform herself, except for one, that one piece being called the Kalich. And basically that last piece wasn't strong enough to be reabsorbed, so she hid it. She hid the Kalich in the body of an infant child. And that infant child was Kali, who we've seen in the last couple issues in the village of the Hidden Water, or Unspoken Water, I should say. And that Kalich, that final piece, was going to be allowed to grow and regain its strength until it was strong enough to return to Mother Salt. And then once it did, Mother Salt would fulfill her husband's wish of destroying the world and having it start over. And so she has, and this is unbeknownst to all of the lesser sea gods that live in the village of Unspoken Water, and unbeknownst to Aquaman himself, because he doesn't have any memory. We know Aquaman died at the end of the Drowned Earth storyline and found himself awakening on the shores of the village of Unspoken Water without his memories. And so the village of Unspoken Water has been hurting for food lately. The waters around the village have been poisoned, and the lesser gods there believe that they've been poisoned by Nama, who is actually Mother Salt, who they turned away because they felt that she didn't, she wasn't harmonious to their life on the island. And they still kept the baby. They still kept Nama's baby, Kali, there. And this is unbeknownst to the lesser gods that live on the island of Unspoken Water. This is all according to Nama's plan. This is all according to Mother Salt's plan. She wanted them to turn her away, and she wanted them to raise Callie to be strong, because the Kalich inside of her would be would continue to grow and once at one point be strong enough to be reabsorbed, and then she could go ahead and destroy the world. And so the lesser gods believe, well, the reason that Nama is now poisoning the water is because we stole her child. But really the reason Nama is poisoning the water is because she knows it's now time for the Kalich to be reabsorbed within her. And so last issue we saw Aquaman go with Callie, sent out by the lesser gods of the sea that live in the Village of Unspoken Water, to go and try to make peace with Nama. And of course, once Callie gets close enough, she transforms into the Kalich. And this series, or this issue rather, starts off with Callie on the shore, and Aquaman's trying to figure out, she's saying, what's happening? And she says, I'm not Callie, I'm the Kalich. And she's got this grotesque form with talons and fangs and all kinds of things. And Aquaman's very taken aback by that. And he's trying to figure out what's going on. So meanwhile, back at the Village of Unspoken Water, the inhabitants there are gathering together, and they feel guilty. They say, we've disgraced ourselves. You know, we sent the children out. We sent Callie and Arthur out to face and fight our battles for us, to defend our ocean. And, you know, there's a little bit of argument amongst themselves. Some of them feel, we're not even sure Andy's entirely human, and they did choose to go. And they, no, it's not right what they've done. That we feel like they're in danger, and why should we value their two lives over the lives of the ocean? And some of the gods are saying, well, I would give my life to satisfy Nama's fury, but there's no guarantee that it would stop her. And eventually they all come together, and they realize that they're all ashamed, right? They, even though they chose to go, Andy and Callie chose to go, these lesser gods made the choice to let them go. And so they're trying to figure out what they should do. So meanwhile, the Kalich is attacking Aquaman, and he's trying to get through to her, saying, Callie, if you can hear me, please don't hold a grudge. And he grabs one of the spikes of salt that is there protruding up from the beach, and smashes it against her head. And what's interesting is we see that this Kalich, it's almost like a shell that Callie wears. It's not her transforming into this. It's the Kalich that's inside of her manifesting itself. And when Aquaman swings and hits her in the face, we see that shell break away momentarily, and we see Callie underneath it. And she's able to talk, saying, Andy, you know, I, and then we see that shell sort of close back up and reform. And then the Kalich attacks Aquaman again, and we get our first look at Nama. And she says, what are you made of, boy? And he says, Nama. She says, and he's like, yeah, who are you that you could stand the touch of the Kalich, and when it should have cleaved you in two? Answer me, who are you? He says, I don't know. I don't know who I am, or what I am, but I'm not a boy. And so Nama takes a smell of him and says, oh, an empty vessel, a shell. It's a pity that you're not yourself. And he says, we come from the Isle of Unspoken Water, and we're asking for mercy on the ocean. And, you know, I brought you your daughter, but you know, what have you done to her? And she laughs and says, my daughter, the human, she's nothing to me. The girl was just a place for me to hide the Kalich until it could grow strong enough to return to me. And now that you've delivered both to me, I'll reclaim what's mine, and I'll be whole again. And, you know, I'll have my vengeance. And Aquaman says, well, what will happen to Callie? Well, she'll probably die. You know, she won't have the strength even to breathe without the Kalich. She's grown so used to having it. But don't worry, I'm going to salt the earth, and everybody's going to die. And you know, eventually. So actually her dying now is sort of a mercy. And Nama calls forth the Kalish back to her, and we see it sort of dissolve away off of Kali and start being reabsorbed by Nama. And Aquaman's not about to let this stand. So he attacks Nama, and there's a bit of a fight, and she calls Aquaman a child, and he says, I'm not your child, and you haven't earned my respect. And as she's fighting, we see that it's having an effect on Kali. It looks sort of like the sand, that shell, or not the sand, but the salt, that shell is being pulled back on her. And Aquaman is yelling, Kali, hold it in, try to hold it in you rather than let it go around you. And so they're fighting over control of it. Nama and Kali are fighting over control of the Kalich, and Kali finds the strength inside her to hold on to it. And rather than, you know, being a shell around her, she's able to pull it inside of her. And we get this sort of hybrid Kalich, Kali creature where it's not that shell, but it's also not a human Kali. Instead, Kali's skin has turned blue and she has the horns that the Kalich had, but she looks much more human. Nama says, well played, but you're too late. I drew enough of the Kalich back inside of me. So, it's too late. I'm going to be able to do what I need to do. And Aquaman says, yeah, well, I've had about enough of you too. And he punches, Nama, and she disintegrates into salt. And so for a moment, Aquaman thinks he's won, and Kali says, well, that went well. And then Aquaman realizes it's not over. And sure enough, we see that cloud of salt kind of drift over the ocean. And out of the ocean rises this giant dragon. And it's got salt spikes on it and giant wings. And it immediately attacks Aquaman and Kali, saying, last chance. And Kali's able to slice at its wings when it's attacking, and Aquaman manages to jump on its back. So Nama in dragon form dives under the ocean, trying to drown Aquaman, which is, you know, probably the most futile thing she could do. But she's traveling at a tremendous speed, and Aquaman's barely able to hold on. And in desperation, he uses his power to communicate with marine life without even realizing it, right? Like it just activates. He doesn't have the knowledge that he has it. He probably doesn't even realize who he's calling out to or who might hear it. It's just a reflex, you know? He just sends out this distress signal out of just instinct. And we see in our world, on our Earth, that many marine animals and many others hear the call. And we even see in Atlantis, Mira, with tears in her eyes, hears the call and says he lives. Also back at the village of Unspoken Water, those inhabitants of the village that used to be lesser sea gods themselves hear the call. And it's what finally drives them to act. You know, they've been feeling ashamed and feeling like they left their fate in the hands of others and sent Andy and Kali out to do their work for them. And so that drives them to walk into the water. When they hear the call, we're told the purity of the intention and the power of the despair awoke something in these villagers that had been long dormant. And they start walking along the bottom of the ocean, traveling to the Isle of Nama, transforming along the way into the old gods, the old sea gods that they used to be, which some of them don't even appear to be quite human. And when they were the inhabitants of the village, you know, they all appeared as very old, somewhat infirm people. Humans. So to see them in these various powerful forms is very interesting. And I love the fact that they're all marching together along the ocean floor head into the Isle of Nama to come to the aid of Andy and Callie, who never should have been sent to fight their battle in the first place. So the blurb is next issue, Battle of the Gods, and we'll see who comes out on top, who survives, and who doesn't. So it's a great story that Kelly Sue DeConnick has told here. I do find it interesting that when she got a hold of Aquaman, that this is the direction she went, you know, to completely strip him of everything he knows, not only in terms of people and allies, but also his own powers and his own identity, and then create this mythos that she's created about Mother Salt and Father Sea and these lesser oceanic gods. It's very mythological in its scope. And yeah, I just find it interesting. Probably need to have her on the show at some point to talk about why she chose to do it this way. I mean, it is sort of a common thing to do when you're going to tell your own story with a hero, to break them down so you can build them back up. And that's not the, and I totally understand that. I totally get that, especially doing it for Aquaman, who at various times has had different sort of personalities, certainly in the 90s when he had the harpoon hand, the Peter David run. And that was the first time we saw him with a beard and long hair. And he was much more antagonistic, much more, I don't want to say violent, but just, you know, more edgy, I guess you'd say, kind of like a lot of the heroes were in the 90s. And then the Geoff Johns run, he was much more grounded and, you know, back to the short hair, clean shaven, that sort of thing. So Aquaman has had sort of these different identities over time. So if you want to, if you're a writer and you want to tell your own story, then yeah, you probably want to break him down and then build him back up. So I totally get that part of it. I'm more curious about the mythological aspect with the gods, what drove her to do it this way, as it were. So, the Robson Rocha art, it's not my favorite of his. I've seen him do other artwork that I've liked more. I can't fault the storytelling at all or the action scenes layouts. For me, it's all about the line work. And I can't even necessarily fault him, because maybe it's Daniel Enriquez doing the inks that gives it more of a scratchy feel. And maybe that's purposeful, just based on the story that they're trying to tell here. It's not, you know, it's more of a supernatural story with, you know, kind of magic and gods and that kind of thing. And so maybe they're trying to evoke a little more of a dystopian sort of feel rather than a clean superhero comic. And certainly when you talk about like the backgrounds and the way Nama looks, the way she looks as a dragon, but, and in her, like humanoid form, the same with the Kalich, you know, these aren't kind of clean designs. There's a lot of moving parts, you know, different sort of spikes and tentacles and teeth and, even the salt spikes on the island of Nama are, you know, they're not in any sort of regular pattern. They just pop up haphazard. So all that contributes to a little bit of a messy visual. And like I said, it's probably purposeful. That's just my personal taste. We all know that I really prefer kind of clean lines and clean looking art in my superhero comics. So, but the visual storytelling transitions from panel to panel, camera work, all that stuff is done really, really well in the issue. So I can't fault the art for that at all. And there's a couple of really great pages, like the scene where Aquaman punches Nama, she turns to salt, is a really great page. So yeah, also the sequence of panels where Callie transforms from having that shell of the Kalich on her to sort of becoming the humanoid Kalich hybrid. That three panel series is done really well also. So overall, really, really good art, really good story. And I definitely recommend the arc of Aquaman, sort of, you know, rediscovering who he is with this sort of mythological backstory that Kelly Sue DeConnick has created. It's good stuff. I think that's going to do it for this episode, everybody. As always, I want to thank you all for joining us, and we'll talk to you next time.
You can find the Comic Source Podcast on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Google Play, or whichever podcasting app you prefer. Please tell all your friends about us, subscribe, and rate us. The ratings really help with our visibility and our ability to reach new listeners, especially 5-star reviews on Apple. Also, be sure to visit us at lrmonline.com to join the conversation, access the show notes, and discover all our other great pop culture content. If you want to email us, the email address is thecomicsourceblog@gmail.com, or you can follow us on Twitter, twitter.com/thecomicsource. Do a search for The Comic Source on Facebook and Instagram to follow us on those social platforms. All three spots are great places to find out when we release new episodes, as well as follow all our convention coverage. So once again, we want to thank everyone for listening, and we'll talk to you next time.